Hello and welcome to Science Unscripted. It's Connor here.
And Gabe.
We are going to begin with an email that asked us to please recapitulate or to summarize a study that was discussed at length in an interview last week.
And the reason why that was asked, because the person writing in couldn't understand from an acoustic perspective the interviewer. That was because there's a perfect explanation for that. The Francesco Panini, who was speaking to us from Milan, Italy, about his sociological experiment about trains and Batman and pregnant women, he had a Batman mask on.
Well, to be fair, that was spontaneous. We were talking to him, and he starts looking left and right and said, well, where is it? Maybe I think it's here. And then he found his latex, expensive-looking Batman mask.
Oh, absolutely.
Put it on, and the mistake that Gabe and I made was to not realize that it would affect the Bluetooth AirPod in his one of his ears.
Because the microphone is in the actual pod.
Exactly. That was our mistake. And thank you for calling us out. And if that was a problem for one of our listeners, it was probably many of you. So the request specifically was, could you summarize that research? Yeah. Okay, I'll pass it off to you, Gabe.
Now, this is exactly how the experiment was conducted. So they had a female colleague at that university in Milan dress up or put something inside her shirt to make it look like she's pregnant, gets on the train. Then they looked how many people offered their seat to this woman.
In a crowded train.
37%. 37%, yeah. Then, same situation, except the second experimental situation that they created was that Batman walked into that train, and then they saw that it was almost 7 out of 10 times that people offered their seat to the woman when Batman was there.
5 meters or 15 feet away through a separate door.
Close enough where you could see there's something definitely going on, and half of the people who offered their seat in that second setting said they didn't even know that Batman was there. So then it raises the question, what's going on there? And that's what Francesca was looking into, the Batman effect, where people do a pro-social thing just because something has disturbed their status quo or their normal sense of...
I think the way you put it last week was that they'd been jarred out of their somnambulance.
Yes. So we're sleepwalking through existence. This is the perspective of Francesco. And when something happens that is so out of the ordinary that we're kind of, I don't know, just slapped in the face or just woken up, then you tend to help people out.
And that was Francesco's advice at the end of it. Try to wake yourself up out of that stare out of the window and daydream the whole time state. Remind yourself, try to be more alert.
Mindful.
Be mindful of the world that you're in and look around. I don't know if you could set an alarm for every 5 minutes if you wanted, or something that buzzes you back awake. Anything you do is best for you so that you see things. And you will probably do more pro-social things because you see them. That was the whole point of that research. Again, thank you to the emailer for alerting us to the audio issue.
It'll never happen again. Next time an interviewee puts a mask on.
A Batman mask.
Now I'll know, you know.
Bad.
Don't do that.
Unless you have a standalone microphone.
Bad man
instead of Batman.
The Batman effect for journalists.
Yeah, unless there's a microphone on the table. That works. We're going to stick to Italy now as we go to another email from one of our listeners. Stephanie says she's a big fan of the show, and she must have gone back a few months to an interview we did with a researcher from Bologna, Italy.
That was this summer, yeah.
September. That was September. And Pia Campagiani is the professor of moral philosophy at the University of Bologna, who conducted a study on students, fundamentally rating professors. And what that study established is that there's a bias that women, female professors, get rated consistently more poorly because of old sexist biases that, to my surprise, I think that was the big thing, that even today's university students still have, at least in Bologna, Italy. The question was, and I thought it was a good one, Stephanie says, I was interested to learn about the Italian study that found males delivering lectures scored higher among students despite the lecture being the same. I'm curious to know if there's any difference in the answer based on the gender of the scorers/students. So the male students might be rating things differently than the female students. And the answer is that yes, but only in one of the two scenarios. So if you read the lectures,
yeah,
and then the name was swapped. So it was either a female professor who'd given this written lecture. You're only reading it. You're not hearing anything. Mm-hmm. If it was written down, males tended to sort of punish, I guess, the female, in quotation marks, authors or lecturers more than
so the... So rating the lecture that was written by a man better than the same lecture written by a woman.
Right. And let me just straight up read it here. It says, okay. With regard to the written passages, because that's what we're talking about here, mm-hmm. the findings indicate that men participants or male participants' evaluations are significantly influenced by what they believe to be the author's gender, whereas women participants' evaluations are not. They're more fair. Mm-hmm. In contrast, for orally delivered lectures, and that's what we kind of recreated when we broadcast that back on September 18th, if
that's
you want
right.
to find it
yeah,
online.
We had a colleague, Neil, read out one lecture and a colleague, Kathleen, read out the other lecture. Yeah.
Right. We kind of recreated it. For orally delivered lectures, both men and women participants exhibit comparable gender biases. So I thought that was actually more sort of more surprising and more upsetting. Mm-hmm. You have both, when you're looking at young university age students and they're listening to either a male or a female professor say something.
Each of them, regardless of their gender, are going to find the male professor delivered a better lecture.
Yeah. And again, just to be clear here, they were evaluating these professors on things like clarity, the benefit for me as a student. Was it interesting? Was the professor confident? And the only time where female professors outperformed male professors was on whether or not the professor seemed to care mm-hmm. about me.
Yeah.
If you're interested, it's a fascinating study. We aired that on September 18th. The podcast episode, if you look it up online, is called Rate My Professor, No Thanks. If you want to go to the study itself, it's called The Boys Club, Gender Biases in Student Evaluations of Their Philosophy Professors in the journal Philosophical Psychology. Yeah. That's the answer to your question, Stephanie.
Yeah, we almost never do this, but you can find us on Spotify and Apple and all these other if, everywhere. That
actually,
you,
I was going to say you can find us everywhere. The more important thing for us to know is if you look for us at the place where you get your podcast usually and don't see us there, send an email.
Let us know.
Yeah, and we'll get people here on that so that we can pop up everywhere.
This is an email from Dan. I have been enjoying your talks on insomnia, and that's right. Over the last few weeks, we've spoken about the concept of insomnia a couple of times. And then he writes, I have tinnitus and also suffer from insomnia as well, busy brain syndrome. To mask the tinnitus, I sleep with the radio through the night. If I wake up, listening to the shows distracts my brain just enough from my personal world so that I fall asleep again. As much as I love your show, I don't think I have made it through an entire episode. Take that however you like. Dan.
That's okay, Dan. If we're having, I'm going to steal another of your words. If we're having a soporific effect
yeah.
on you when you need it most.
That's wonderful.
Can you, yeah, what more can we do?
Yeah.
Really.
And just to stay with that topic, there was a study published this week and looking in for the first time straight up at life expectancy and insomnia and comparing it to some of the other factors that can lead to a lower life expectancy. So they were looking at diet, exercise, loneliness, smoking, and sleep between 2019 and 2024 all across the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And then what they were doing, they're having people compare self-reported evaluations of sleep. And what they specifically did here was if you were getting less than 7 hours of sleep per night.
A lot of people.
Then it was insufficient. So essentially, what is the effect of having less than 7 hours of sleep on your life expectancy compared to those other things? It is the worst of all of them except smoking. So it's worse for you to sleep less than 7 hours or fewer than 7 hours with regard to diet. It's more important that you sleep well than eat well.
So you could be stuffing your face with the worst foods, but and if you sleep more than 7 hours a night, you're going to have better health outcomes.
Yeah, you're not going to die as young, I guess, is the way to say that. Exercise. It's more important to sleep well than exercise, apparently. It's more important to sleep well than to have social contact. So loneliness is not as bad for you as insufficient sleep. The only thing that was worse with regard to life expectancy, smoking. So
don't do that.
Don't smoke.
Yeah.
Don't smoke and sleep well.
Yeah.
See you later. See you later, Connor.
Don't, Gabe sleeps poorly and does sometimes smoke. No, the other way of putting it or thinking about it is in the larger zoom all the way out evolutionary perspective. Mm. Sleep is very costly. It's very costly. We have 24 hours of the day, and if you sleep 8 hours of that, you've lost a third.
Yeah.
So it must be very, very important for the Homo sapien body to do that, to justify wasting, in quotation marks, all that time.
And for those productive people out there who think that it's so important what you're doing in those hours when you're not sleeping, keeping this research in mind, maybe it isn't. Sleep is absolutely vital to living a long life. Longevity and sleep are deeply connected. Another more proof of it here.
One last study, kind of a quick one from my end. It really is just association. Don't go out there and change young children's lives based on this study.
Okay.
Canadian university and an Italian university on this one. And the conclusion that most people will draw from it is that young children, particularly between the ages of 6 and 10, if they're involved in organized sports activities, and then later between the ages of 10 and 12, you ask them survey-wise, which is, again, weaker than objectively assessing this from the outside, do you respect authority?
Do you respect authority?
If you ask them, the ones who were involved in organized sports activities will be more likely to say, yes, I do.
Uh-huh.
That's what we can say based on
this study. If they're on a team.
Correct. Okay. Correct. Team. Okay. We're talking team sports here.
Yeah.
This is a longitudinal study on about 1,500 boys and girls. And again, it really is just association. This was just one of the questions on the survey that they answered, and it turns out there is a correlation here. There are clear critiques because are those possibly the kids who could respect authority and hence stayed on the team? I know plenty of kids here locally, here in Germany. I think there's a statistic I've seen that 90% of sports activity here in Germany revolve around what I would call soccer, others would call football.
Mm-hmm.
And some kids end up not being on those teams. They either get kicked off explicitly or quit. Because they can't really adapt to that structure. So those kids are kind of automatically out and then may therefore obviously have problems with respecting authority. That may be why they're not on a team.
That's why they,
But if you're a teacher or somebody involved with children and you happen to hear them say that they, you know, that they play on such and such team, whatever that sport is, there's a higher likelihood that they will respect you as an authority figure.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes sense because anyone who has played on an organized sports team knows this is a hierarchy and what your coach says is kind of the law, especially at that age as a kid. And if you can't deal with that or accept it or grow, learn how to accept it, then you may not have a long future on that team or in that sport.
Now that you say it, I have three kids and two of them aren't on teams. And those are the two that are I think they have authority issues.
Really?
The one on the cheerleading team, no authority issues whatsoever. The other two, I don't know what I'm going to do with them, Connor.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's
put them on a team. Wait, but the village that we're in down in Uncle Germany, the only teams they have, I don't know, racquetball. I guess you
get them. Oh, yeah, that's a classic for kids.
Badminton.
You know all those kids with those racquetball trading cards that they pass back and
forth.
That's
all they have down there.
And those posters on their walls.
What should I do? Anybody got any tips for me?
Well, no, I do. I do because you're going to causal where it is just associative. You nobody out there listening right now who knows a child that age should think I'm going to solve. You know what? That's just a crazy, out of control iPad kid who doesn't respect authorities. I know how to fix it. Yeah. I'll sign him up for a pickleball team. Probably not going to work. But if they're passionate about a team and they can accept that authority structure, and you hear that they're doing that, they're probably going to respect your authority more. You can say that. I think for teachers out there, that's probably kind of relevant information.
I just wanted to say before we go, the title of the sleep study with the life expectancy, sleep insufficiency and life expectancy. In the United States, 2019 to 2025, if you want to check out the details on that.
Well, if you're going to do that, I have to do mine.
I knew you were going to.
It's called Game Changer, How Middle Childhood Sport Predicts Reduced Oppositional Defiant Behavior by Early Adolescence. And that's in European Child and Adolescent Psychiatry.
Yeah.
You can look that up if you're interested. Do you have any anecdotes? Gabe has his children who line up kind of one-to-one with the study about organized sports activities. Anything to say about professors and whether you've experienced that unfair rating system?
Yeah. Or how are you sleeping and how what are you doing to sleep? Is it like our guy Dan you turn us on and then we just bore you to death or to sleep, as it were, let us know at SUETW.com.
I think we should, well, I mean, I agree with love of humanity. Mm-hmm. And I think we should try to do things that help our fellow human beings. Mm-hmm. But it's very hard, like if you care about the reality of goodness rather than simply the perception of it, it's very difficult to give away money well.
You probably know it, but that voice belongs to the world's richest human being. That's Elon Musk. Speaking to...
He's talking to Nikhil Kamath. I think I'm pronouncing his name correctly. He's a podcaster, vodcaster, interviewer who sat down for a very long time with Elon Musk. And one of the things they talked about there was charity.
The question was, what do you think about philanthropy? And then Musk, who incidentally is on the path to becoming the world's first trillionaire, was trying to explain why he thinks giving his money away well is so difficult.
It's easy to scoff at that, but the longer you think about it, the more complex it gets. And kind of coincidentally, a new paper on who gives and whom they give to or don't just came out, and it gave us a chance to look deeper into that idea.
Science Unscripted.
Yeah, hello. My name is Isabel Thielmann. I'm a research group leader at the Max Planck Institute for the Study of Crime, Security and Law. I'm a psychologist and I've recently conducted a research study together with a PhD student on prosociality and individual differences therein.
Isabel, you were looking primarily at charity or giving. What was the primary conclusion of your recent work?
So what we looked at is at whether people are selective in their prosociality when they can select between different beneficiaries of their prosocial behavior. So give to some people, but not to others. We did multiple studies. In most of them, we actually manipulated the nationality of the beneficiaries. And we found that people seem to give more money to some nationalities than to others. We also manipulated the religiosity of the beneficiaries and checked whether people, for example, primarily donate to people from the same or with the same religious affiliation as compared to people from other religions.
I'm going to focus on the first part of that, nationalities, but I'm actually going to dial it back a step further because in order to understand which nationalities are receiving or not receiving charity, we need to know which nationality is giving the charity.
The giving nationality was U.S. Americans in this case.
Okay, and who were they giving to or not?
So they could either give also to another American person or a person from the U.S. And this is sort of like in-group favoritism, right? So we also saw that people from the U.S. tend to give more to other people from the U.S. compared to other countries. But we also saw that some people just distinguished or discriminated actually between other countries that were on the table. And for example, one reason was that people said, oh, I gave more to this person because I like this nationality more. Or they said, well, I gave more to that person because I think this person from that country is more needy than a person from another more wealthy country.
And which nationalities did those Americans tend to like more than others?
So across studies, there was actually differences in whether people favored a certain nationality or another. So for example, in one study, potentially, people favored others from Germany, whereas in another study, they favored others from France. So there was no real conclusive evidence which of these countries they actually behaved more pro-social towards. But overall, we just saw that there are differences in whether people treated all countries the same or whether they treated them in a different way.
And what were the reasons that they gave for giving to one nationality compared to another?
So people told us different reasons, but most of the time they actually said that they liked people from one country more than from another. So it was just basically their preference to give to some more than to others. Also, many people said that they perceived people from a certain nationality to be more needy than from another nationality. So, for example, we had people from Italy, and they were perceived as more needy than, say, people from Germany.
And the countries or the people in the countries that could be donated to, these were all exclusively European countries, meaning it was kind of like a level playing field?
It was almost all were European countries, except for Canada and Australia. But what we try to ensure is that they are actually all very similar in actual wealth, so that people would not discriminate based on wealth. But apparently they perceived wealth differently.
Let's get into the differences between the givers. Again, specifically, we're talking about Americans. But
yes,
who is it that gives to everyone equally, like a truly, where the playing field is absolutely level, regardless of national origin or religion? And who is somebody who is much more selective?
Yes. So what we saw, for example, is that people who in general are in favor of hierarchies, we call that, for example, social dominance orientation, people who score pretty highly on that and who actually like to see differences between groups, they were also the ones who tended to differentiate more, to discriminate more between different beneficiaries, whereas people who are low on this trait, who are, for example, more liberal, they tended to give the same to everyone.
And how did you find that out? Did you have the participants in the study, did they take a psychological test, or what did you do there?
So we actually had multiple trials of a behavioral game paradigm. That's how we call it, meaning that people went through multiple trials where they could give some money that we gave them. They could give that to a certain recipient. And we played that a couple of times while changing the characteristics of the recipient. And so you can actually see who gives the same amount to everyone. This would be a person who is not selective at all. Or some people actually gave much more to some recipients than to others. And these were then, according to our measure, more selective.
And what did you learn from your study about how human beings tend to give when it comes to charity?
So what we learned is that actually some people tend in general to be more universal. They just do not discriminate between other people when it comes to their pro-sociality. Whereas other people who also admire, for example, hierarchies in general, they also are more or they tend more towards discriminating between different beneficiaries. And they, for example, tend to give more to other people or, for example, charities they like and they feel affiliated or associated with.
I'm trying to visualize the person you mean when you say somebody who likes hierarchies. I've never met someone on the street who's like, you know what I love? I love watching a good soccer game and I love hierarchies. You know, like it's just not a... who is that person? Can you help me see them?
Sure. Yeah, these are usually people that are in favor of traditional values, for example. You know, who are not... you do not have very egalitarian worldviews, but who actually like to, for example, have a leader and then have these different groups of people in a society. Whereas those who do not really endorse hierarchies, they are the ones who are primarily in favor of egalitarian values and of equal opportunities and so on and so forth. So these would be maybe a little bit more liberal and less traditional in terms of these worldviews.
Gabe and I were just watching a video of the world's richest human being talk about how it's difficult to give well in a way that actually helps humanity. This was Elon Musk, who may become the world's first trillionaire at some point. And it got us talking about that idea, about whether human beings at the individual level can give well. Because, for example, very few people would donate their hard-earned money to spider research or bat research because those animals are ugly. And so we don't do it. We would give it to pandas, but we're very biased and very selective. And so I guess very, very general question, maybe far beyond the scope of your study. Do human beings give well to charity?
I mean, that actually very well aligns with ideas coming from the effective altruism movement. Do people give money to those charities, for example, where €1 or $1 makes the greatest difference for the beneficiaries? And unfortunately, people do not seem to tend to be effective altruists, but they rather give where they think something makes a difference, or where they have a connection to the people. So it's more like an affectionate reason. People want to do good and want to feel good about that. And it feels like a calculation to think about where their money would make the greatest difference. So people do not seem to choose the charities based on these effective altruism ideas.
For all of our listeners out there, if they're thinking about donating, or have that feeling some of us have sometimes, I should do more. I've got some extra money in my pocket.
Yeah, or if they're lucky enough to have money to donate.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Exactly. And where should they start? How can they be better?
I mean, as I said before, I don't think there is a right or wrong of donating. Donating in general is great, whether it be for local communities or for broader scale. Say environmental protection charities or something like that. But as I said, people can at least gather some information online to see where their money makes a greater difference than at other places. Then again, I think you just have to feel good about donating, because then you may also donate again in the future. If you have the feeling you can see a difference based on what you gave, that's great. And it doesn't need to be money. You can also volunteer. And that's, of course, a local community then where you can spend time or invest your time for a good cause. So I don't think there is a right or wrong, but just gather some information online and then just do it.
And that was Dr. Isabel Thielmann talking to us from Freiburg, Germany, down in the south. She's a research group leader at the Max Planck Institute for the Study of Crime, Security, and Law.
Safe home in Freiburg following an injury that she suffered in Oman, hiking.
Yeah.
She broke her
fibula.
Fibula.
So just a little bit of background there. It was her first day back at work at all after weeks, and she talked to us there, which I think was really nice. After going through a canyon in Oman and breaking, it's like the bone next to your shin bone, the fibula.
Yeah.
And then was flown back and had surgery. She's doing better now. She's on the up and up. Very nice of her to talk to us there about charity despite all that.
Yeah. Can you imagine breaking your leg in a gorge in Oman? How scary that must be?
Yeah. Hearing it is what she said. She heard
cracking.
She heard it snap.
What do you guys think about this? The idea of giving. Where do you stand on it, and what you learned today, that people differentiate when it comes to who they give to based on whether they like that person? Is it completely natural to you?
Or does that
surprise you?
Should there be a different system for charity? Let us know. As always, we're su@dw.com.
DW. Made for Minds.